Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Plains on the Prairie podcast. I'm Max.
And I'm Sam.
And we are coming back at you today with another Marine Corps ace.
Yeah.
This is our second one of the Minnesota series so far. And he's actually from an area that's near and dear to my heart, Albert Lea, Minnesota. This one, you know, it's sad that it's kind of becoming the norm that we can't find more information about these guys' personal lives, either before the war or after. But this pilot, John Roosom, had a pretty incredible career.
Yeah, we really had to dig deep for it, but we were able to find, you know, some secondhand accounts about him, some squadron history that included his achievements. So I think it's going to be a pretty interesting episode for you guys still, even with that unfortunate bit that we couldn't find much on his personal life.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, without further ado, I say we hop right into it. So John Roosom was born on September 7th, 1922 in Albert Lea, Minnesota. And growing up, at least from my personal experience, my grandfather spent a lot of time in Albert Lea as a boy. So Albert Lea is about 15 miles, maybe less, from the border with Iowa. So especially during that time, Albert Lea was a big hub for railroads, especially the Rock Island Railroad, probably not Santa Fe at that point. But, if you're a big railroad fan, Albert Lea definitely would mean something to you as trains were coming up and down through Iowa and Minneapolis. The early, probably late 30s, early 1940s, John attended the Iowa State College, which is now Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa.
For those of you who know the Max lore, he's a big...
I'm a diehard Iowa Hawkeyes fan, so that is no ill intent towards Iowa State, but go Hawks.
A little bit, yeah.
A little bit, yeah. And did he graduate, or did he have to drop out because of the war?
He did graduate. He did, okay. He graduated in 1942, it looked like.
Gotcha. So. And I assume, was he probably in Naval ROTC
there? He was in the ROTC there, and that's how he kind of got his commission.
Gotcha. So, with that, Roosom was commissioned in the Marine Corps in October of 1943 and earned his wing shortly thereafter. His first taste of action came on April 12th, 1945, while assigned to VMF 323, the Death Rattlers. He shot down an A6M0 just northwest of Lashima, which is Okinawa, if I remember correctly.
Yep, just kind of in that area. Just you're kind of getting into the Ryukyus at that point, getting on the doorstep. So.
Gotcha. And by, April 1945, that's almost end game for the Japanese right there.
It is.
There.
The desperation started showing. Iwo Jima was concluded about this time and onto Okinawa. Those of you who have seen, kind of those mainstream shows such as like The Pacific, it paints a really good picture about how, the war was turning well towards the U.S. at that point and the Allies. It wasn't over, though.
Right. No. The Japanese were going to fight for every single inch of land that they had. Just 3 days later, he shot down a Ki-61 Tony over northern Okinawa, and I would say this is very impressive. May 4th, 1945, he shot down four D-3A Val dive bombers in one flight, just unassisted.
There was a few of them. His wingman got three out of the deal too.
Gotcha.
So it was kind of a turkey shoot.
Yeah, was going to say that sounds like a turkey shoot. And that same flight, he was also credited with three damaged. So, oh my gosh, they must have just gone in there guns blazing.
Yeah, and this was the time of the war where you probably wouldn't see the D-3A Vals as a conventional dive bomber anymore. Those of you who are well-versed in Pacific War history may know the D-3A Vals were the dive bombers that were introduced to the U.S., I guess, at Pearl Harbor. So almost four years earlier, they were there, and they were starting to show their age even then. Their fixed gear, quite slow compared to a Corsair, which is the fastest, one of the fastest aircraft of the war. So
it was just easy pickings for...
Well, and you got to look at both the Germans and the Japanese suffered the same thing. pilot attrition. The quality of pilots went super low, you know, at this point. 44, late 44 was when you started to see the kamikaze. Mm-hmm. All the kamikazes were taught to do was take off, and that was about it. Landing was kind of helped by the instructors, mm-hmm. more or less, towards the end of the war. So they just needed to know how to take off. They didn't know combat evasive maneuvers. They didn't know anything like that. Basically, these VALs were loaded down with explosives. Can't confirm, but most likely not armed in the tail by the turret gunner. They're just heading for shipping.
Whatever ship they could find first.
Yep, so there was 25 of these VALs going towards Allied shipping that day. And him and his wingman got 7 of them and damaged 3 others, which, you know, maybe they didn't make it to their target.
Right.
So for his actions today, on this day, on May 4th, he received the Naval Cross. The Naval Cross.
Wow. So. You just got to think, you know, how many lives they saved by taking down those possible kamikazes. You know, there's no way of knowing now with the research or, you know, information available online. But, you know, you got to think, an outdated dive bomber in the Pacific, late war, mid-1945, they're probably kamikazes.
Yeah, well, and look what one can do. We've seen it. The St. Lo, the escort carrier, mm-hmm. took 1-0 to the deck and just sank it within minutes. A rival with nothing to lose is the scariest kind.
Absolutely. So. That gave me goosebumps. So. Very good. Very good quote. So I think we're up to 6 kills at this point. Not unfortunately for him, Rusum actually did score a 7th kill. We have been unable to find anything on that kill.
And I know this has been a cliche the last few episodes. I don't know how about you, but I spent about 3 or 4 hours just looking through articles and accounts of, you know, the air battle over Okinawa. Couldn't find it.
I have 2 books that talk about Marine Corps aces and Corsair aces. And again, scouring them, I was hoping that it would have a list of each pilot and each day that they scored mm-hmm. their kill, but nothing.
Yep, dug deep, but not deep enough, I guess.
I guess. We should mention that Rusum was nicknamed Eagle Eyes by fellow squadron mates in VMF 323 because he could spot planes very long distances out before anyone else, which is a good trait to have if you're a fighter
pilot. And as a pilot myself, I can point them out when no one's looking for them, but then once the air traffic controller's telling, okay, you got traffic at 3 o'clock, I'm not going to find it. So I don't think I would fit in well with him.
Right.
But, and then I did also find kind of last minute his other nickname was Gruesome because it...
Oh,
Gruesome.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good one. That's cool.
So...
Gruesome. I like that.
Yeah, and we couldn't find much. It seems like much for after his time during World War II. But it seems like he did stick with VMF 323, which eventually became VMA 323, all the way through Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the war, he kind of bounced around different Marine air bases. I did find one little snippet where he was the XO for the Seattle Air Marine Air Detachment around 1956. This was a kind of found in a source from an Albert Lee newspaper.
Oh, cool.
And he was a major at the time, so he worked his way up. He was a second lieutenant when he got all his victories in World War II.
So freshly commissioned, just a young guy. Wow.
Yeah, so he did see time in Vietnam, according to a couple sources, but I couldn't find any unit history or anything like that. And eventually, in the 70s, he was actually a... junior ROTC instructor at a high school I believe near Cherry Point.
Wow.
So
imagine having him as a teacher. Holy cow.
Yeah, they said he was, if he liked it, he was really good to you. So, really? So that he sounds like a tough Marine, but
kind of a off topic conversation here, but one of my high school teachers, his dad was a Corsair pilot, I think with the Navy during World War II. And there were a couple times after class where I'd sit down and we would talk, like, you know, I didn't have anything going on, and he'd say, oh yeah, my dad was telling me that he was, you know, flying low through the mountain over Iwo Jima, and he could see the Japanese soldiers running from cave to cave and shooting at him with their rifles, and he said his dad would laugh because it's like, yeah, what are the chances? But
still could
happen. Yeah, still a little scary.
You know, aside from, you know, inner service, you know, rivalry beside, but I don't know. For me, it's all Brave. Don't get me wrong.
Oh, yeah.
But just the carrier aspect of it. I mean, off topic again, but reading about, you know, Battle of Leyte, Phil C., all those, there's this one mission where everybody took off last minute and they got back in the dark. And they're landing on different carriers, or not on a carrier at all, landing in the ocean and things like that. And it's just like, to be a Navy pilot in World War II or a Marine pilot off of a carrier, just something else. Yeah. I don't know.
I'd say, you know what's of steel.
Oh, yeah.
Got to keep it G-rated for the little listeners out there if we have them.
And the only other snippet was he was Inspector General of the Reserve Command at Cherry Point.
Yeah.
But, again, not much, but a lot of, you know, on his passing, I found a couple of forum posts about, you know, just some little snippets about him and his life. You know, the ROTC thing found from a kid who was a student of his back, you know, back then. And then he found out he died about a year after, and he posted to this Marine thread and kind of did a write up on his on his history. And pretty much what we found here was one of the major sources.
Absolutely. We should say that John Roosom passed away on June 27th, 2009, at the age of 86. And I believe, was he in California?
I believe he's in Florida. Yeah. Okay.
That would make more
sense. One of the retirement states.
Yeah. And he is buried in Arlington National Cemetery. So very fitting for an ace, in my opinion.
No kidding.
Yeah. So now we will move on to the squadron history, VMF 323. VMF 323 was formed on August 1st, 1943 at Marine Corps Air Station Cherry Point in North Carolina. And VMF 323 wasn't, you know, taking the lineage of a previous Marine Corps squadron. It was established just for World War II.
Right.
Gotcha. Nicknamed the Death Rattlers after an incident where three Marines of the squadron captured and killed a rattlesnake. That ended up becoming their squadron mascot, if you want to say mascot.
Yeah, it was a physical dead mascot in their ready room.
And they had it mounted. And
I couldn't find a picture of it, but I don't know if you've ever been to Texas Roadhouse and you see like the snake pelts on on the wall. That's all I could think of. It's just a snake pelt just sitting above the ready room.
And then they were initially equipped with Chance Vought early F4U-1A Corsairs. Still not quite the birdcage.
Nope, just after.
Just after. So
with the slider canopy.
Gotcha.
Couldn't find, I mean, it's not in our notes here, but couldn't find when they transitioned to -1D Corsairs, but they did at some point.
Cool. And then they trained for much of 1943 and into 1944. Before being shipped off to sea combat in the Pacific, where they would eventually be launched from the USS White Plains. Now, that is a... I assume that's an escort carrier.
It's an escort carrier, yeah.
Wow, that is a carrier I have actually never heard of before this. Where they were sent to Kadena Field, which is Japan... Well, no, it's Okinawa. Big Air Force presence these days. On April 9th, 1945, in support of Operation Iceberg... during the Battle of Okinawa.
So he was in early.
Yeah, he was. Absolutely.
I mean, his first victory 3 days after.
Yeah. It's surprising. Obviously, where would the Zeros have been land-based from Okinawa?
Potentially, or just, you know, from the other Ryukyu Islands and stuff like that, too.
Gotcha. Because there were no Japanese carriers present there, were there?
I don't believe there's any left.
Yeah, I was going to say. There were there at the bottom of the ocean. So between April, the Japanese and the Japanese surrender in August, the squadron achieved 124 aerial victories without a single loss of one of their own aircraft. That is worth mentioning.
It is very impressive. I mean, aside from the Japanese quality of pilots, the kamikaze, it's still impressive.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean,
no combat loss.
Yeah, even with fresh Marine Corps pilots. You know, you have a green pilot going against a Japanese green pilot. You know, it's a flip of the coin. Yeah, nothing's guaranteed. So,
well, in the Corsairs, you know, operationally, it was kind of a tough airplane to fly. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a reason it wasn't a very popular carrier aircraft in World War II.
Right.
And, you know, they were on, you know, launch from a carrier. There's no accidents there. And it's just impressive that no combat losses.
Right. Absolutely. So they were attached to Marine Air Group 33, or MAG 33, aboard the USS Badong Strait. I hope I said that correctly. Badong, whatever. Badong Strait in support of ground forces. This is during the
Korean War. This is Korea, yeah.
Gotcha. After the war, they were assigned to Marine Air Group 33 and supported U.S. ground forces during the Battle of the Pusan Perimeter, the landings at Incheon, and the Battle of the Chosin Reservoir in 1950.
Three very big names.
Yes, especially with Devotion.
Devotion
came out,
yep.
2 years ago now. Really highlighted the Marine Corps' horrible experiences during the Chosin Reservoir battle.
Terrible combat conditions and just
makes me
cold.
Yeah, freezing cold. You know what? I didn't even realize that's in North Korea.
Yeah,
like modern day North Korea, and unfortunately, all those guys that were never recovered are probably still
there. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's something else.
Mm-hmm. The Death Rattlers bounced around through various bases in Korea and Japan over the next 4 years. Obviously, with the changing battlefield after China entered the war, a lot of those Marine Corps units and Air Force were all pushed back down into modern-day South Korea, and then were reassigned to Japan, just more than likely for occupational duty as well as,
a little rest.
Yep. Exactly. So they were redesignated as VMA 323. So the VMF designation went away and was added with the A in June of 1952 and equipped with F4U-4B and AU-1 Corsairs until they returned stateside in 1953, where they were re-equipped with Grumman F9F Panthers and later the F9F Cougar. And then they were re-equipped with the North American FJ-4 Furies in 1956, which, if you don't know, are the Navy versions of the F-86 Sabre.
I was
going to say one of my favorite airplanes, if you've been following the Fargo Air Museum for the last year,
Little sidebar, little spoiler, whatever, I hope it happens, is a friend of my grandfather's actually flew FJ-4 Furies. So I am trying to find a time to go down to Sioux Falls and interview him. He's in a retirement home down there, or at least get a phone call with him
right,
so we could get some information. But
that would be super cool. Can't imagine there's a lot of Fury pilots left, unfortunately.
No. And they weren't the most widely used aircraft either, so there's just not many of them in general.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Go ahead.
No, that's basically the rest of the squadron history is... the squadron didn't change a lot of aircraft after the Fury. In 1964, they were actually redesignated VMFA 323, so just adding the fighter attack.
Yeah.
And they were equipped with the McDonnell Douglas F-4 Phantom II.
Ah,
so one of your favorites.
Yeah.
And throughout the mid to late 60s, from 65 to 69, they were deployed to Da Nang Air Base and Chulai as well.
Gotcha.
In South Vietnam. And then after that, they came back stateside for a while, and in 1982, they transitioned to the McDonnell Douglas FA-18 Hornet.
And they're still flying
today. In later versions of that today.
Gotcha. Wow. Well, it's, again, so cool that a squadron that has such a distinguished history during World War II is still around today.
Right.
And, those pilots can, trace that lineage, that heritage, all the way back to... especially, one of the most pivotal battles of not just the Pacific Theater, but the war in general.
Exactly.
Like, and it's literally pounding on the door of the Japanese homeland.
Right. Well, and so far in these five episodes, all of the squadrons have some modern lineage.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they're still around a little bit, mm-hmm. at least. So we've been pretty fortunate with that. So that's been really cool.
Absolutely. So our final section today is surviving aircraft. And I think we should mention the article that we referenced for some of these, some of the information was actually the squadron history, like the official naval history of VMF, 323. And on the cover, it was super cool, is one of the Hornets in formation with a warbird VMF 323 Corsair. It might have been a VMA, because it has the famous WS tail code that the squadron used in Korea. But unfortunately, it was a black and white image, very grainy. I think the article was published in 1987.
Yeah.
So it was too hard to pick out either the bureau number or the FAA registration on that Corsair. But we know that at least one of them existed at some point. Don't know if it's still painted like that. But I should mention that if you do see a Corsair with a big WS on the tail code, for the tail code, more than likely it's painted as a VMFA or VMF 323 Corsair.
Right.
More than likely from the Korean era.
Yeah.
Again, we've covered this in the past, both, I think, actually, we didn't have any Corsair aces from North Dakota.
This is our first Corsair ace. So,
really?
Yep.
Really?
And our second Marine ace. We've only had two
Marine aces. What did the first Marine ace fly? Was that?
That was Doyle just a few episodes ago with the Wildcat.
Oh, Wildcat. Yeah. Oh, wow.
So,
wow,
we've had a really...
this was our second Corsair ace.
This is a very diverse
bunch
here in Minnesota.
Go Minnesota. Sweet. Okay. No, I was going to say... it's hard to say because the Navy all painted their Corsairs very similar. There mm-hmm. were very little, identifying marks or schemes, that, you know, would make you think, oh, this aircraft was assigned to this squadron versus, you know, another one.
Right.
I know a couple Corsair schemes have like VMF or VF 41 or 323 painted on the fuselage, but if they didn't have that painted on there because, you know, the squadrons were on the same carrier, you took whatever plane was available.
Right.
But, you know, compare that to the United States Army Air Force where, you know, they were flying. It reminds me of an old meme I saw of kind of relating the French Zouaves during World War One.
Yep.
And it's Peter Griffin, just brightly colored.
Yep.
That's funny. We should mention that a replica VMF 323 Corsair is on display in front of the Proud Bird restaurant in Los Angeles.
If you can get me to California, I might check that out.
I know. I'd have a burger and look at some fiberglass airplanes. I mean, what's better than
that? That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that wraps it up for this week's episode. You know, again, we're sorry that we can't find more information on the private life of these guys, or I shouldn't say that, on the personal lives of these pilots. Just, you know, it was cool to see Albert Lee again. My late grandfather, Paul Sabin, grew up in Albert Lee, and I've been there many times.
Yep.
Many times. There's not a whole lot there, unfortunately, today. It is, I shouldn't say it's not a big town, but mm-hmm. it's, you know, average size.
Sure.
But no, and you know, that's kind of a cool callback for me. So,
exactly.
I thought that this was a great episode and.
Yeah, it was fun to get the Corsair ace in there.
I know.
We're still kind of debating on what to do for next week, but, we do have, a good lineup. Ready to go down the road.
Though. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, with that, anything else, Sam?
No, I think that's it. We thank you guys for tuning in again. And this is five weeks already.
I know.
Doing this, so.
We're rocking and rolling.
And we have 20 plus weeks. So,
yeah.
So
oh,
this is a thick series.
We
so.
Have a lot. We'll, like we said, we might take a break and cover either, you know, some event, take a break from the aces for an episode or two, but.
Yeah, we'll make it work.
Cool. So. All right. Thank you, and take care, guys.
All right, we'll see you.